Good morning, I'm Tommy Howe, and welcome to another edition of Tree Huggers International on KBZT FM 94.9, a weekly natural science and environmental affairs program for the listeners of FM 94.9 and San Diego and all of Southern California, from the beaches to the mountains to the deserts. This is Tree Huggers International. Be careful and use this show with caution, because you might just learn something. If you're out in the backcountry of the Central Coast, you may find yourself craning your neck, perhaps fixating on a bird slowly moving about the sky. The bird may seem unusually large at first, yet still far away. But while sizable birds like red-tailed hawks are frequently seen throughout the wild areas of the Golden State, if you're along the Central Coast, Ventura County, Santa Barbara County, some of the wilderness areas behind Ojai and west of Tejon Pass, that big bird you're looking at may be something else. A relic of millennia past, which, through the help of man, manages to cling to survival today. But while man is in many ways responsible for this species still being here, we're also responsible for its decline over decades of abuse and carelessness. And so it is humans have an odd relationship with the California condor. On one hand, a success story, and on the other hand, a front row seat for the fight of a species to survive. Joining us today is a guest who was instrumental in the recovery of the California condor and has moved on to a myriad of other interests and pursuits, especially his Escondido-based EcoLife Foundation, which is sponsoring the upcoming Walking for Water 5K walk in Mission Bay Park on October the 4th. Bill Toon is the founder and executive director of EcoLife. He earned his Master's of Science degree in Avian Sciences from the University of California, Davis, where he studied the reproductive biology of the condor. Following grad school, Bill pursued his interest in the condor and was ultimately assigned to the federally appointed California Condor Recovery Team. Since then, his conservation work has carried him to all corners of the planet, including Antarctica, and his background includes national park work in Madagascar, sustainable development programs in Costa Rica, old-growth logging studies in Papua New Guinea, recovery of the giant peccary in Paraguay, sustainable management practices in Argentina, and many, many more. More and more, Bill and many of his colleagues became worried by the apparent disconnect between the quality of life for people and the health of their natural resources. In 2003, with scientists and colleagues, Bill worked to establish the EcoLife Foundation as a way to help fill this important and neglected niche in conservation and the environment. And we are exceptionally fortunate to have him here today. I really appreciate your time. Bill Toon, welcome to Tree Huggers International.
Happy to be here, Tommy. Thank you.
And I want to talk about the upcoming Walking for Water 5K on October the 4th and your work with the EcoLife Foundation. But first, I wanted to talk a little bit about your significant role in the recovery of the California condor. And I think most people are reasonably aware the Central Coast, especially the inland coastal ranges, that's condor country. But what specifically makes up the condor's habitat, and how wide a range does it have? I mean, can you find a condor in other states or in Baja?
Well, you can now. When I got started in the California Condor Program, actually one of my first jobs was to go out and get some poop from a wild condor. And that was a real task. There were 21 birds. They were only found in a little horseshoe range in the southern central valley of California, spanning about 5 counties. So while these days you can go to the Grand Canyon and see them, you can go into Baja California and as far up as Ventana and find condors. That wasn't the case then. It was a real challenge. So in many ways, you're right. This is, at least so far, a really wonderful success story for a bird that was right on the precipice of extinction.
And so they were really just on the southern edge of the Central Valley. Like, were they over as far east as the Tejon Ranch?
Yep. Oh, they made a lot of use of Tejon. Tejon, what condors look for is they basically have three needs. They have a foraging need, they have nesting needs, and they have roosting needs. And Tejon Ranch provided a lot of those different things, and so is a very valuable area and remains a very valuable area for the California condor. Open grasslands are where they're finding their food. Big trees are where they're finding places to roost. And then the cliffs and caves are where they nest, actually caves.
When did it become apparent the condor was in pretty serious danger of becoming extinct? And had it been a situation with its numbers dwindling for some time?
Yeah, very much so. This is a bird that has been declining for a very, very long time. And it first became you know, kind of an issue within the state of California way back in the 30s with a guy by the name of Carl Coford working for the National Audubon Society and doing studies on the decline of the condor. At that time, there was probably over 100, maybe 200 birds in the wild. But even at that point, I mean, today, you know, we would look at any population at that level, and that would be just a panic emergency that you're in danger of losing it. The condor is very fortunate, really, that it's very long-lived and in many ways an extremely resilient bird, that it hung on for as long as it did until the modern recovery effort started.
Is it true the condor is something of a relic species?
You know, no, it's not. I mean, only in the sense that if you were to use the term relic to describe the age of the California condor in terms of its evolutionary history, you would be describing things like house sparrows and starlings, and most importantly, you would be describing Homo sapiens, you and I, as a relic species if it was based simply on age. The term relic, I think, comes up with the condor only because we clearly have what is a remnant population of a pretty majestic creature.
So it would not be accurate to say the condors were around at the time of the dinosaurs or anything like that?
No, not in the form we know them now. This is a different bird. This is a modern-day California condor. And this is a bird that was not on, and this was a big challenge of the early recovery program, was that there was an enormous amount of political pressure from groups saying that the California condor had been on its decline towards extinction and was doomed to extinction. It had outlived its usefulness. Its time in the world was gone. On and on and on. Those became really enormous battles that we had to fight in order to be able to take any steps to preserve the species. And now, as we look at causes of decline in the condor, overwhelmingly it's man that has impacted this bird. And to say that it was due to go only if we're done with it.
Yeah. Well, lead ammunition was recently outlawed here in the state of California. How much that's enforced is really depends on where in the state you are. But was that a primary cause of the decline, or was it just habitat loss?
It's a combination, but I mean, certainly lead poisoning has been a very big deal with this bird. And I'm sorry to say that the changes in laws in the state of California are only local in terms of the California condor. And as long as lead's available, you're going to be unable. And we're seeing evidence of it very clearly now in the wild birds. This is not the way to solve it. Lead's one of those funny things, you know. Right now, we'll panic if our kid's lunch pail has a trace amount of lead in it. You watch them redoing old buildings in Balboa Park, and everyone's in a hazmat suit. And yet we'll allow people to load their rifles and shotguns with it and spray it over the landscape and into our waterways. Or even worse yet, the good hunter who brings food home to eat has no idea that when that bullet impacts an animal, the cloud of lead that's spread through the area of impact that they're ingesting when they bring this home and feed it to their kids. So this issue around lead often gets twisted into an anti-hunting battle, and that's not the issue at all. This is a dangerous toxin. We've known it was poisonous to man for more than 2,000 years. The lead goblets that the Romans used were making a bunch of dumb kids as a result of the lead toxicity. So this isn't new. Anything else in our mainstream culture today as toxic as lead would have been banned if it wasn't for its use in rifles and ammunition.
How about the habitat loss?
Habitat loss is always critical to a bird like this. This is a bird that makes amazing trips each day. I'll tell you briefly about the very first time I saw a condor. And I had been sent out to collect a fecal sample from a bird. And I'd never seen one in the wild. And I spent a lot of time, you know, you're staring through your binoculars and a monarch butterfly going by really close looks good. And a turkey vulture and that sort of thing. And yet it was never that bird. They were very rare. And I made the decision to climb to the top of one of the mountains, Mount Pinos in the area, and get up on the ridgeline. And I was going to sit there where I could see 360 degrees until I saw a California condor. Well, as luck would have it for me, just as I approached the ridgeline, it was very hot. It was a very unpleasant day. I was very sweaty and unhappy. And all of a sudden, I found myself chilled and with goosebumps because I was in a shadow in a spot where there were no trees. And this bird had come across the ridgeline from the other side. You're talking about a bird with a wingspan of a Volkswagen Bug. And he saw me about the same time I saw him. He was no more than 20 feet above me. And it's a spectacular bird when you look up at the silhouette. Obviously, it blots out a lot of sky, especially that close. And on the end of each of these tremendous wings are 10 primary feathers that stick out like fingers. And I remember so clearly seeing those individual feathers just twist and dumped the wind, and the bird came to a dead stop, to look at me. And after a moment, he decided he'd seen enough, and you saw those feathers go planar again, and he moved away like someone putting a silent Mack truck into gear. It was obvious he wasn't going to stop, but it was silent and easy the way he moved away. I watched that bird then pick up the thermal that he'd come over the ridge for, and he went up, up, and up, straight up above me without exerting any energy whatsoever, and did what we birders call dotting out, where he disappeared from my view. And I realized then why the Chumash Indians had believed that this bird flew into the spirit world and carried the spirits of their dead into the spirit world. You could see them do it, literally. But once this bird reaches full altitude, which might be as high as 5 miles up, all they do is tuck their wings in a little bit and fall. And at 60 or 70 miles an hour, they will travel effortlessly for 100, maybe even up to 200 miles. So a day of travel for the condor covers a lot of ground. And as we see their habitat being chopped up, either by development, agriculture, and other uses, all those things impact a bird with a range like that. Wide-ranging animals are hit hard. The one thing that seems to help the condor certainly is ranching. This is a bird that you will not find them down on a street eating dead rats or squirrels that you've run over. They're looking for large carcasses. And for a long time, many people thought that this was why it was a relic, because it couldn't find dead dinosaurs anymore, which of course wasn't the case. But it does have a preference for these large carcasses like deer, cattle, sheep, that sort of thing. Bear in mind, it's no threat to the farmer or to the rancher, because this bird doesn't kill anything. Their feet are extremely weak. The only way their beaks can access flesh is by going through soft parts of the body or through a hole caused by another animal. So really, these were the cleanup guys. And so ranching was a good thing for California condors, as well as access to the beach, which, as we know, throughout California has been pretty heavily restricted or eliminated, because the beach was a source of, again, larger carcasses, whales, dolphins, sea lions, things like that.
Now, I would imagine with the condor population today, even the myriad of wilderness areas along the central coast of Mount Pinos, the Chumash Wilderness, up to the Dick Smith, San Rafael.
Right.
This is not enough room.
No, this is the thing. You know, you and I can drive down the highway and look around and see a lot of space. We both know by getting into a plane and flying over it 4 miles, all of a sudden you get a very different perspective of that space in the context of what's out there. And I think this is one of the reasons why it's very important to the recovery team to create separate populations of condors in different areas where there were more open spaces. I think we're not naive enough to know that California is just going to continue to have problems. In fact, pretty much all the areas that the bird goes to. But being able to buffer those problems by having other populations and areas that are in less danger of development and encroachment than many of the areas in California are seem to be a very important part of the strategy.
So how was the recovery devised for the condors? And I'm sure this wasn't overnight.
No. It's a really interesting process when it works well. And it's a little bit of a disaster when it doesn't. And I feel very fortunate that I was on the recovery team in a very dynamic period of its time. And part of that strength came not only from members of the recovery team, but in fact from the way the recovery team was managed by federal officials. Right now, certainly over the last decade or so, recovery teams have very much been unable to function without a great deal of oversight and pressure on them from the federal government. At the time I was involved, we were given the charter, really, of looking at the biological problem. And then we were to discount the organizations we represented, we were to discount budget, we were to discount politics, and simply devise, and not that it would be implemented, but devise in a perfect world what would be the perfect way to recover a species. And then, of course, it would get hammered up after that. But just the opportunity to start in such a clean and healthy place with a plan was really wonderful. So the recovery team really at that time was only hampered, interestingly enough, primarily by the environmental community. And that pressure came from the history of the California condor with a really wonderful biologist and a really wonderful writer, and who I've mentioned already, Carl Coford with the Audubon Society. At the time that the recovery team was starting and recovery efforts were starting, his book, eloquently titled The California Condor, was the only book out there. And he'd made it pretty clear in his writing that if you went into condor habitat, that they would leave it. If you went to a nest site, the pair would break up and never breed again, and if you touched a bird, it would die. this in spite of the fact, as we go through Coford's old records, there's many a photograph of him sitting in their nest with chicks and feeding adult birds and that sort of thing. But what he was doing was providing the experience that many of us had as children, which is parents who tell us, don't touch a bird because they'll smell you. Don't touch the babies in a nest or the nest because the parents will smell you and never come back. Well, birds don't have a sense of smell in general, but it was a great way of protecting nests. And what Carl was trying to do was protect his condor. And unfortunately, Carl died long before we were able to unsnarl that mess that was created. And so there was a tremendous feeling that we should just let this bird go, quote unquote, gracefully into extinction. And we can talk about more, but having held a bird in my arms as it died of lead poisoning, I will tell you it's not a graceful way to go.
If you're just joining us, this is Tree Huggers International on KBZT FM 94.9. My name is Tommy Howe, and we're talking to conservation biologist Bill Toon, the founder and executive director of the Echo Life Foundation. You can learn more about the Echo Life Foundation at www.echolifefoundation.org. That's ecolifefoundation.org. We're talking about Bill's groundbreaking work with the recovery of the California condor and his ongoing conservation work around the globe via the Echo Life Foundation and the Echo Life Foundation sponsorship of the Walking for Water 5K happening on October the 4th. You can now register a team of up to 10 people for the Walking for Water 5K. Team registration is $200. Everyone who registers, you get a Walking for Water t-shirt. There's going to be a water education expo, H2O zone water challenges, and live music, food, and drinks. You can call area code 760-740-1346 to register. That's 760-740-1346. You can also go to walkingforwater.com. And that's walking4water.com. And we'll go over all this information again at the end of the program. Getting back to the condor and those recovery strategies, I mean, part of that was collecting eggs in the field and then rearing condors in captivity. Was there any point where every single condor was literally out of the wild?
Yes. It was absolutely the case. It was also the most awful thing. And, all these things are made more difficult sometimes by politics. It was a very small team of us at the time actually doing field work on the California condor, made up of the federal, state government, Audubon Society, and primarily the San Diego Zoo and Wild Animal Park at that time, and just one or two people from each of those organizations. And there was never a group that was more dedicated not only to the California condor as a species, but to the concept of the absolute importance of always having condors in the wild. The thing we feared the most was the vacuum of not having condors out there. And those fears primarily came from two areas. One was a loss of political clout. Under the Endangered Species Act, you can only protect habitat for a species that's in that habitat. So technically, we could lose legal battle to protect property without the birds there. But more important even to us was this fear that we would lose tradition in the wild, this knowledge of how to use the habitat. And we didn't want to find ourselves in the position of having to teach, think that we would have to teach them how to do things. So we were, when the last bird started coming in, we were accused of all sorts of plots to make this happen, when in fact the contrary was true. We had done everything we could to keep a bird out there, but it reached a point, and it was a document that still exists somewhere in a federal archive that was nicknamed by a handful of us who signed it as the Bloody Valentine's Day document. It was written on Valentine's Day and submitted, where we buckled and said these birds have to come in order to have any chance of saving the species. So indeed, we actually had the bird go functionally extinct in the wild.
Now, a lot of the recovery methods were unique, were innovative, were revolutionary. How did you go about convincing folks who were holding the purse strings, superiors, etc.? How did you go about convincing them this was the appropriate way to handle this recovery? Or was it a matter of what we say in the broadcasting business sometimes, forgiveness over permission?
Yeah, well, there was a combination of both those. Speaking for the work I got to do with the program, I had the most amazing boss one could ever hope for, Dr. Art Risser, who is a spectacular ornithologist, also out of UC Davis. But he was also one of those people who could hand you an oar and say, start paddling like mad. I don't care how you get over there, just do it. And so an enormous amount of confidence from people like that. And then we were also very fortunate that at the launch of the program, the federal government had actually set aside what at the time was just an astronomical amount of money of $21 million was set aside for Condor recovery. Today that wouldn't get you too far, but at the time it was huge. So we were for the time very well financed, and in terms of those of us handling the birds one on one, we had a reasonable amount of license. In the field, we had some real difficulties. One of the big problems is to anyone who sees a condor in the air, it's they immediately class it with a hawk or an eagle, and in fact, taxonomically for decades, the condor was considered to be, or all the New World vultures were considered to be, a spin-off of the birds of prey. Well, in fact, they're not. They're a flying flamingo or stork. And you would find people trying to handle them in the field as though they were a bird of prey. And both condors and people ultimately were damaged by that. When the zoos got involved and we brought to the field biology the experience of handling animals in zoos, it was actually a big benefit to the condor, and started training people that this is not a bird of prey. Bird of prey, if you are a falconer and you're collecting an eagle or something, you're going to control its feet because they will foot you. They have very sharp talons and powerful feet. Condors have feet like a chicken and a beak like the devil. So we'd see these guys, grab the condor's feet and the bird would turn around, bite the living heck out of them, which a bird of prey is not likely to do. So it was a lot of learning how to handle the bird in the field. Once they were in the zoos, it was kind of a frightening thing in the sense that really no one knew anything about it anyway. They'd never been raised in captivity and that sort of thing. So pretty much if you said, I think this is a good idea, there wasn't anyone out there qualified to argue with you. And while our techniques were viewed as radical, revolutionary, and exciting, the funny thing is that they really weren't. The arm puppets that Art Rister and I created, along with the very famous puppet ladies of San Diego out of Balboa Park, were really very fun for us to do, and not revolutionary at all. We'd learned about it from early Roman falconers who used stick puppets to raise the falcons for falconry. And the only thing different about the puppets we used is that we call them functional, and that is that the beak opened and closed, and we could actually feed the condor directly with the puppets. So they were fun to create, and to be quite honest, they actually worked on a couple of fronts. One is certainly in the first few days of the life of a chick. That was mama, without any question about it. And that was very important to us, and it was a great, great tool. The other thing is it was very media attractive, and what the condor really needed at that point was some good media. We needed to turn this tide of people who felt that we had to leave it alone, that we couldn't succeed, that we couldn't keep it alive. And nothing cuter than a day-old chick being reared by a puppet, and it did just what we hoped it would do. It turned the tide. When I picked up the first egg out of the wild, it was very traumatic thing to do, and that was in 1982, and it was the end of 4 years of knowing this bird only as a wild bird. As I told you, I had watched them go up to altitudes of 4 or 5 miles, these fantastic trips they would take soaring, all the things they could do. And at the moment that Dr. Noel Snyder and I sat in that cave and the mother female condor wheeling by the front entry of it to see what we were trying to do just 6-8 feet away from us, and I was going to pick that egg up and put it in a box, and I realized at that moment that under the recovery plan, if that egg was fertile and if that chick hatched and survived, it would spend the rest of its life in a cage 80 feet long, 40 feet wide, and 24 feet tall. And it was an emotional challenge at that moment. And so when I picked it up and put it in the box, I made a personal promise to myself that I would stay with the program until we got a bird back in the wild. And so the only way I remember that is I know it was in 1990 I got to resign from the California recovery team and move on to other things, but it took way longer than I'd hoped it would take.
We all know San Diego is in the midst of a major water crisis right now. We've still got rationing in effect. And as I understand it, San Diego imports 85% of our water from endangered sources.
Correct. First, to put it all in perspective, is that the world is in a water crisis. And as with many wealthy communities, we're the last ones to acknowledge it. And so San Diego falls squarely into that category. But it is interesting to note that today the Colorado River no longer dumps into the Sea of Cortez. And while that might seem like a minor note to people, I remember growing up hearing so many people say, "Oh, that water running out into the ocean is wasted." Well, when the water from the Colorado River ran into the Sea of Cortez, one of the important things it did was carry nutrients. Nutrients that supported an enormous commercial fisheries in the Sea of Cortez, kept a lot of people employed, and many, many, many more people fed. Today, that fishery in that part of the sea is dead. The sport fishing moves farther and farther south, out even now past Cabo, past the point of Baja California. So this is in large part due to the Colorado River not dumping in there anymore. What this meant was that a lot of people were put out of work in the area. Many of those people either immigrated to the United States looking for work or set up doing agriculture along the border region, agriculture that was able to survive because of the seepage from the aqueducts. That's gone now, too, as we line the aqueduct and yet another group of people find themselves displaced and put out of work. And so the options with water are really tough, and now we're about to do the same thing to ourselves. I'm sorry, but I know there's a little fish up in the northern part of the state that we're all really worried about. But
the Delta smelt.
The Delta smelt. But I refer to it as our red herring, because the answer is you read it in the newspaper literally every day when there's a water issue. Why do we have to not do something because of this smelt? Well, the smelt's a red herring. If you go up and you talk to anyone who manages rivers going out to the coast, most importantly who manage steelhead fisheries and things like that, we no longer have an opportunity for salmon and steelhead to reproduce along our coastline. Our fisheries are going down the toilet. And it's not because we need water in San Diego, it's because we love to waste water in San Diego. You look at 99% of the people who live in the United States of America, and they don't know what it means to turn a spigot and not have water come out. More importantly, they don't know what it means to turn a spigot and be unable to drink that water that comes out. When you realize that every 20 seconds a child is dying from waterborne disease around the world, and we flush our toilets with drinking water and water our plants with drinking water, it is only out of our naivete that we use water the way we do. If we were as aware of what the impacts of our use are and how other people have to address their water issues, I think we would treat it differently. And this is a big part of Walking for Water. We're not about scare tactics or anything like that. We're really about solutions. But solutions come from someone being inspired to do something different and make a change. And sometimes a little bit of perspective about how fortunate we are to have the resources we have and how important it might be to someone who's not as lucky as we are that we not waste them is one of the ways we can encourage people. But one of the fun things about our day there will be that we're about solutions. We're not about telling you about how awful things are going to get or whatever, but here's what you can do to help. There's many parts of the world. You mentioned my work with the Chacoan peccary in Paraguay. If you were out in the Gran Chaco of Paraguay, any place outside of the cities, no one would dream of building a home without a rainwater collection system. There's no municipal water out there, and they depend on the water they collect from rain. When you hear someone in this community say that we don't get enough rainwater to bother collecting it, first of all, when something's rare, it's the best thing to collect, and certainly it's rare here, but the dry seasons of the Paraguayan Chaco will make our droughts look like nothing, and yet these people are willing to are able to survive by collecting rainwater carefully. This is something that's just terribly overlooked. I live on just shy of 3/4 acre of property in Escondido. I'm very fortunate to have a piece of land. I have put in both rainwater collection and re-landscape my yard to prevent runoff. By not allowing rainwater to run off my yard, I collect 220,000 gallons of water in a normal rain year, which we haven't had in a while. And when I say collect, I mean it's gone into the soil, it's going to run through the system, it's going to end up in our waterways clean. If it runs off the front of my property and down my street, picking up everybody's lawn debris, dog waste, oils, herbicides, pesticides, and then into the waterways, it's a big problem. So it's just a matter of being thoughtful about what you do with your yard.
Well, and it shouldn't be that when it rains,
everything becomes a toxic event.
Right.
That should not be the case. That is certainly not normal.
I mean, let's face it, whether we approve of it or not, no one has better ideas about how to have a healthy economy without having a growing economy. We depend on and look for growth in our community to stay economically healthy. I'd love to find a great model that will keep us well without that, but I don't see one yet. Water is going to be our greatest limiting factor here. Allowing it to slip away from us is tough. I mean, let's look at it this way. San Diego's one of their biggest sources of income is tourism. And you're right. When we have rainfall, it becomes a toxic event. We have hundreds of days of beach closure every year in our community because of our inability to manage our waste and the fact that we let it all run off the way we do. We are destroying our own bank account. And if we want to have a healthy community, both economically and physically, these are things we have to pay attention to. Well, we'd love to have everyone come out to Walking for Water and enjoy the day with us. We're going to have a really wonderful group, Diversified, which is a reggae group that will be lots of fun. Firehouse Brewing Company is putting on a beer garden for everybody, so we'll have an opportunity for some real fun while we're out there. And that this all needs to be fun, this learning process. And then with us, there's going to be some great sponsors who are going to provide really easy ways. And the one thing I want to remind everyone is that it's a disposable water bottle free day. Come with reusable stainless steel or plastic containers. We'll have some for sale there. You'll be able to refill your bottles with great water from Pure Water Technology, but leave the throwaways at home.
Bill, it was great having you on the program. We'll have to have you back on again sometime and talk about some more of your globetrotting. And
thanks, Tommy. It was great to be here today.
Good having you on the program. We'll talk to you next time. That's going to wrap things up for this week's edition of Tree Huggers International on FM 94.9. I'm Tommy Howe. Thanks again to Bill Toon, the founder and executive director of the Ecolife Foundation, for joining us to talk all about his work with the California Condo Recovery Program, as well as the upcoming Walking for Water 5K walk at Mission Bay Park on October the 4th. Again, team registration is $200. Everyone who registers gets a Walking for Water t-shirt, and there's going to be a Water Education Expo, H2O Zone Water Challenges, live music and food, and generally a great opportunity to get some exercise and learn all about water and water use here in Southern California and around the world. To register and to get more information, go to walkingforwater.com. That's www.walking4water.com. walkingforwater.com. You can also call area code 760-740-1346. That's 760-740-1346. Also, the website for the Ecolife Foundation is www.ecolifefoundation.org. ecolifefoundation.org. ecolifefoundation.org. Hopefully we will see you Sunday, October the 4th at Mission Bay Park. The opinions and views expressed on Tree Huggers International do not necessarily reflect the opinions and views of the staff and management of FM 94.9 or Lincoln Financial Media, and as producer, I am solely responsible for this program's content. Questions, complaints, concerns, compliments, we'd love to hear from you. Go ahead and email me at tommy@fm949sd.com. For more information on Tree Huggers International and to hear previous editions of the show, you can go to the Tree Huggers International page at the FM 94.9 website. That's www.fm949sd.com/treehuggers. Tree Huggers International will also be resuming operation at treehuggersintl.com. That's treehuggersintl.com. This is Tommy Howe for Tree Huggers International on KBZT FM 94.9. We'll be back again next Sunday morning at 5:30 with another take on natural science and environmental affairs in our corner of Southern California. But in the meantime, get ready for another edition of Nina Blackwood's New Wave Nation next on FM 94.9. Have a great Sunday and a good week. Be well.